From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Millions of individuals were denied paychecks, were unable to feed their family, were denied SNAP benefits to give children and the disabled and the elderly assistance in their food. I think that is the crudest form of a political weapon that I can imagine.
That's U.S. Senator Dick Durbin explaining his vote to reopen the government. He is one of a handful of Democrats who made that vote, siding with Republicans, and he's come under fire from his fellow party members for it. We'll talk about that and more coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week, Patrick Fingston, the author of the Illinois Political Newsletter and a radio host at WMAY in Springfield. Patrick, always good to have you back with us.
Gentlemen, it is a pleasure to cross over from commercial to hoity-toity, highfalutin public radio.
we'll try to keep this on the low side here, I guess. So, Patrick, let me start by talking about Dick Durbin. He could have, I guess, taken the easy way out here. He is not going to run for another term. He's made that announcement. He could have basically continued to side with his Democratic colleagues and said, no, we're going to keep this government shut down until the Trump administration and Republicans do something about these health care subsidies. We've been gone, 6 weeks on this shutdown? And now many people think that he caved in, along with a few others, to reopen the government, and that this really weakens Democrats and helps Republicans. I want to get your thoughts on it.
I guess I just don't know what Democrats got for all of this, right? This was the whole point of the shutdown. Was over these ACA subsidies, right? Where we subsidize people, and there's no income cap through the end of this year, that are on those Obamacare, those ACA plans. That was their line in the sand. They got a vote promised by John Thune, the Senate Majority Leader, but there's no such promise in the House. And there's no way Donald Trump signs anything that helps something that has Barack Obama's name on it. So even if it passes the Senate and the House, Trump's going to veto it, and it's never going to become law anyway. So they still lose on the issue. If this was about SNAP, I don't think he's being completely honest about it, because there was already a court order that told the Department of Agriculture that they had to fully fund SNAP. So they needed the courts to do their job in enforcing the rulings and in telling USDA what it had to do, instead of just claiming, hey, look who's getting hurt here. So I just, from both a policy and political side here, I just don't understand why he and other Democrats decided now was the time to go ahead and bite the bullet and take this one.
And I've seen some people who are getting their are getting ready to pay their health care premiums for next year. They're only now starting to see some of what the cost would be. I mean, so again, it seemed like the pressure was mounting really on both parties, but certainly on Republicans who control the House and Senate, and Donald Trump controlling the presidency, to do something about health care. And they may still end up doing something about health care, but it seemed to take some pressure off. So is this one of those things that's going to hurt Durbin's legacy, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think Republicans don't like him anyway, right? So it's not like he has a legacy to hurt with Republicans as it is. The people criticizing him on the left, or the people who are already sort of against him inside that party, right? The Juliana Stratton is just an extension of the long-running Pritzker-Durbin feud. Sean Kasten's always looking to pick a fight with the establishment, right? Even Krishnamurti and Robin Kelly were measured in their statements of contempt for the vote. So yeah, progressives are mad, but you know, when Dick Durbin steps off the stage after, you know, 40 whatever years in Congress, I don't think Democrats are going to say boo this man because of the healthcare vote.
Yeah, Charlie, let me get you in here on this, because you've known Dick Durbin a long time. Whether you like Dick Durbin or whether you don't like Dick Durbin, you have to say He has been a leader for the Democratic Party for a long time. He knows more about politics than most people do. And I would say that in some cases, maybe people have to trust his decision here. But I want to get your take on it.
Yeah, and I think I tend to agree with what Patrick said, in that there was really no easy way out for the Democrats, in that you start with the premise, and I'm sure this is what Durbin believed and other people have said it, is that there is no way that Donald Trump is going to do anything that would reflect well on Obamacare. From day one of his candidacy, he's attacked it. He's kept talking about we're going to do away with it and come in with something better. Never got around to revealing what that something better might be. So no matter what was going to happen, Trump was not going to do anything that would help the folks who are going to lose their medical coverage or have to pay higher premiums for the Affordable Care Act. And the other thing, I think, is the consideration that Trump really doesn't care about anybody other than Donald Trump. And the fact that people are going to be suffering without their food stamps, I don't think that bothers him one little bit. And I've said to other people, now what they really needed to do was to have in there somewhere money for his fancy ballroom. Then he would have been really interested in getting something done. But that didn't happen, obviously. And the other thing is that, from my perspective, and from having watched Illinois government for a long time, the Republicans in Congress are basically gutless, spineless, with the exception of a couple of people. They're afraid to stand up to Donald Trump. And so they weren't going to go against their leader's wishes to support anything to end the shutdown. And it would require Democratic votes. And if you think about it, if I'm not mistaken, the Democrats who voted with the Republicans to send the bill to Trump, there were a couple who were retiring, not running again, Durbin being one, and the others who voted for it don't stand up for election again for 4 or 6 years. So they're sort of insulated from whatever the blowback might be. So I think it was just a calculated judgment. What can I do to end this suffering? We talked about playing with other people's lives, people who weren't able to get food, people who weren't able to pay off their bills because they weren't getting paid, the federal employees. So that would be my take on it. One interesting kind of side note was that while Durbin was getting attacked from many different sides, one of the people who came out in his defense, of all people, was the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune. They ran an editorial, and it was titled, this was a couple of days ago, and it was entitled, "In Defense of Dick Durbin, Honorable Public Servant of Our State."
Well, Patrick, let me ask you, Durbin and his party, you mentioned there's this long-running feud among some other people in the party. Where does this go or come from, I guess, and how far does it go back?
Well, I mean, and I don't know that I can tell you the origin of Durbin v. Pritzker, but certainly it heightened a few years ago after the resignation of Mike Madigan as state party chairman, when Durbin wanted Robin Kelly to be chair and Pritzker had someone else in mind, and Durbin essentially won the first round, and Pritzker reorganized and had Robin Kelly bounced to state party chair and replaced with Lisa Hernandez, one of his people. And there are even, you know, thoughts and rumors and innuendo that Robin Kelly's campaign for U.S. Senate as an African-American woman is more in line to block Juliana Stratton, the governor's current lieutenant governor, from winning that Democratic primary for governor for Senate than it is to actually go in and win. I don't necessarily believe that, but I mean it's a long running beef between the two, and you know I think they've tried to play nice in public over the last few years, but there's certainly been simmering under the water for a while.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to watch that. Meanwhile, we have an election just around the corner in the spring. We'll be having having primaries for a lot of different races, including for governor on the Republican side, as we have some candidates who have decided to, again, challenge J.B. Pritzker. And one of those is Darren Bailey. And Darren Bailey, there was some thought, Patrick, he was maybe going to bow out of the race. Just a tragic situation that occurred a few weeks ago where his son and daughter-in-law and two of their children died in a helicopter crash in Montana. But Bailey came out this week and said after some thought, after prayer, he has decided he is staying in the race. I guess, was it really in doubt at some point?
In the early days after the accident that killed his son, his daughter-in-law, and two of their grandkids, yes, it was. From my understanding, yes, it was. It was something that they talked about not wanting to go through again. It was, you know, Darren and Cindy Bailey, and Darren Bailey turned 60 on primary day in March. They've essentially taken in the third grandkid from Zach and Kelsey Bailey's family that was not on the helicopter that crashed, and he survived and is certainly going through a lot when his entire, you know, family dies. And there was a lot of thought early on in the process that maybe they wouldn't continue on. There was a call to the Baileys from President Trump that weekend after the accident where he encouraged Darren Bailey to stay in the race, to keep fighting. And so this dates back to even, I think the story that I did initially that said that he was going to stay in the race was late October, like the 29th. So this was, you know, this has been in the works for a couple of weeks that he was going to stay in the race. They just made it official this week. The question is, how long does he stay off the campaign trail? I've heard it could be through the end of the year that Darren Bailey's not doing events, not out there on the ground. Does that mean he's not going to make fundraising calls? Does that mean he's out completely? In which case you're seeing an almost unprecedented situation where a lieutenant governor candidate in Aaron Del Mar is essentially running for governor as the LG. And it's just, it makes a really interesting dynamic for a gubernatorial campaign.
You have to have empathy, even if you disagree politically with somebody. You have to have empathy for the Bailey family. And I know we've talked about this in the past. Having to run for governor is not an easy challenge because you have to be in a lot of places. You have to talk to people. It is a lot to take on. And I can't imagine trying to do that while people are still grieving from something like this.
Yeah. And I've mentioned before, the worst possible thing I think that could happen to anyone is to lose a child. I've lost both my parents, obviously. That was hard, but they were older and they had lived their full lives, and it's inevitable. Nobody is immortal, right? But to lose a child, I just can't imagine how terrible that would be. So the fact that he decided to go back, had he decided to bow out and say, okay, Del Mar, you be the gubernatorial candidate, I could understand that. And another thing I think that makes it difficult for Bailey or any Republican is that Pritzker is an overwhelming favorite. Part of the problem, and we've talked about this before, is that the Republicans have no money. The big donors have moved, they've gone down to Florida. And if I'm a wealthy Republican would-be donor, am I going to put money into a governor's race in Illinois, that's really long shot? Or am I going to put money into U.S. Senate races and U.S. House races in other states that could determine whether or not Republicans can keep control of Congress?
Yeah, Patrick, where is Darren Bailey looking to get money from if he's serious about taking on J.B. Pritzker?
That's a really good question. We've already seen the Dick Uihlein, the Uihlein products, paper products guy, businessman from the North Shore who has, you know, who bankrolled a lot of Bailey's campaign 3 years ago, has given money to Ted Dabrowski. Some of Bailey's previous supporters have given money to Dabrowski. The interesting thing here, though, is that this may be the rare campaign where Bailey may not need that much money to win this race, because he has almost universal name ID among Republican voters. And they generally still like him. They like that Christian, almost fundamentalist Southern Baptist preacher sounding super social conservative politics. That's what primary voters are looking for. And if you get a Trump endorsement, if you get, you know, if you can tap into that MAGA base, essentially, which he already has them on his CRM from 3 years ago, then you're the leader in the clubhouse, no matter how much money you have. The question here is if there's anyone in the race who can come in and drop millions of dollars on their own, and that could completely turn the race upside down.
And there's also another name now in the race for governor as well, somebody that I think probably is not on most people's radar. Fill us in on that.
Well, so that's Rick Heidner, who can come in and drop that multi-millions of dollars. He's a businessman from the suburbs, runs a big property company or commercial real estate company, also works in the video gaming, has a video gaming company. Essentially, that's all we know about him, right, is his business interests, is the fact that he was trying to flip some land for a racino that was proposed in, I think it was Tinley Park, back in 2017, 2018. And one of J.B. Pritzker's first things as governor was canceling that project because it was, quote unquote, mob ties. So certainly one could believe that Heidner has an axe to grind there. He put enough signatures together in 10 days to get on the ballot. I looked at his petitions. There were something like 16,000 signatures, far more than enough to get on. They were ugly petitions, messy, probably would have had a lot of pages, a lot of lines struck, but I don't think he would have gotten kicked off the ballot or anything. It would have, so he never got challenged. So he's on the ballot. The question is, we don't know anything about his politics other than the fact that he's for video gaming and he seems to be a Trump supporter, right? That's all we really know. We don't know what kind of campaign he wants to run. We don't know where he's going to be on social issues. We don't know if he's going to have a business focus. We don't know what his policies are, what he's going to do, what his vision is, anything about his campaign. There's been no announcement. There's no website. There's no social media. I can barely get through to a staffer to try to get an interview with the guy, which I still haven't been able to do. And I'm as plugged into Republican candidates as any person in the media in the state, I would argue. And it's really a giant question mark to see that you have this candidate running for governor that's already put $1 million of his own money in his campaign, and he's an absolute ghost.
Yeah, Charlie, do you remember anything like that before? I mean, we've seen some candidates come out of nowhere, often with some big money, and people weren't sure about them, but usually they had sort of laid a little more groundwork, it seemed to me.
Yeah, I can't recall anyone who, as Patrick said, is pretty much a ghost. You don't really know anything about him. And if I'm not mistaken, Patrick, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Hasn't he also been a contributor to Democratic politicians back in the day?
Oh, has he ever? He gave $25,000 to Brandon Johnson. He gave money. He gave almost $100,000 to committees controlled by Mike Madigan. He gave money to Kim Fox, the former state's attorney in Cook County. All things that are going to go over really well with Republican primary voters.
Yeah, and as I say, I can't recall anything like it where somebody kind of comes in where you don't know hardly anything about that person. Has no background in public service or anything to give people an idea, if you said, what his politics may be. So he is just sort of a mystery man, so to speak.
Well, let's stay on the election beat here a little bit more and talk about redistricting, because, Patrick, there is some thought still, and Governor Pritzker is the one that opened this door, saying that is still a possibility we could see congressional districts redrawn before next year's election, even though candidates just filed their petitions here in the state of Illinois. Is that likely? Is it something that's really still on the table? He was saying they're waiting to see what Indiana does, because Indiana's talking about doing a redistricting to benefit Republicans. Of course, Illinois would do it to benefit Democrats. How real of an idea is this?
Yeah, and that was sort of his new line after the election last week was, well, we're going to wait to see what Indiana does. And that's not something he had talked about previously. So I think there are a couple of different questions here. Is one, does it really benefit them? Does it really benefit Democrats to gerrymander Illinois even more than it's already gerrymandered all to heck? Right. You've got 14 out of 17 districts now. If you make a 15th, you're going to either, you know, you're probably trying to, the rumor is that they're going to try and carve up Darren LaHood's district. Right. So you've got to pull Democratic voters out of Champaign, out of Peoria, out of Rockford, right, and out of some of those exurbs that have turned more Democratic in recent years, to be able to draw that 15th Democratic seat. In which case, you're weakening districts that are currently represented by Democrats, like Nikki Budzinski here in Springfield, like Eric Sorensen in the Quad Cities in Rockford and Peoria, like Lauren Underwood, who's out in the exurbs, and Sean Kasten, who's got some Republican areas in DuPage County, and even down into like that Mount Greenwood part of the city that's the some of the few Republican parts there. And you're potentially weakening some of your incumbents, which you have to wonder, does that put those seats in play when there is inevitably a Republican wave again? And there's going to be a Republican wave again someday. There was in 2010, there was in 2014. It'll happen again someday. These things are all cyclical. So what does that mean for Budzinski? What does it mean for Sorensen? Well, they're still publicly supportive of this. And when I asked Budzinski, when I had her on my show last week, about do you want to have this fight, you know, or are you comfortable with watering down your own district and making it more competitive? She basically just gave me the tough, you know, the, I guess I can't say tough guy, tough person answer of I'm always ready for a fight. But I think that does lead to some legal questions though. I compare it to last year when you may remember when Democrats tried to end slating for legislative seats toward the end of the spring session, as Republicans were trying to slate a candidate against Katie Stewart down in the Metro East, and Republicans sued. A judge said you can't change the election procedure when the election is already running, and that's sort of where we're at now, right? Petitions were being passed, petitions have filed, the election is underway until the March primary. So I don't know that they can even legally change the maps, change the election while it's currently running. So I have a really hard time believing this actually comes to fruition, even if Indiana happens to draw a 9-0 Republican map.
Yeah, as Patrick mentioned, there is a court precedent saying you can't change the rules of the game in the middle of the game. And were this to occur, what it would mean is that the 60 plus candidates already filed for Congress in the existing districts, they basically, all their petitions would be thrown out. They'd have to start over from scratch. And it would require the legislature would have to change the date of the primary from March. They'd probably have to change it to June to give people time to do that. And I just don't think it's going to happen. There was interesting, a column that was in the Tribune the other day by a Bloomberg opinion columnist, Marianne Klass, who said that she pointed out that there'd be a danger for the Republicans that in winning election, President Trump won roughly 48% of the Latino vote across the country. And as they go to do the redistricting, the Republicans are assuming that these voters would stay with them. But she quoted a Republican political consultant who said that assuming that they would support Trump in 2024 was believing their own press clippings here, which is dangerous. And in fact, the candidates who won in the election a week ago, they did really pretty well with Latinos.
Well, and that's the risk Texas is running, right? They're basing all of their new map on how well Trump did with Hispanic voters in 2024. And, you know, we've seen those numbers just flip on their head since all of these ICE raids and immigration actions and rhetoric from the Trump administration. So there's serious questions about whether Texas, whether Missouri, whether, you know, if Illinois did it, if you'd wind up with a dummymander more than a gerrymander.
Yeah, yeah. And the exit polls for Virginia, New Jersey showed that Latino voters abandoned the Republicans in massive numbers, and many of them supported Democrats. So the notion that in an election when Donald Trump is not going to be on the ballot, his name will not be there at the top of the ballot, are the folks who maybe voted for him in 2024, are they going to be voting according to his wishes in 2026? Or particularly people who have been impacted by the shutdown, by the loss of food stamps, by just the general economic conditions, are they going to stick with Trump's recommendations and say, vote for a Republican? Or are they going to go back kind of to their historic roots and vote Democratic?
And we'll continue to watch that. It's time now for our notes from the field. Patrick, we'll go to you first this week.
So even when one party is in the doldrums in this state, think about Democrats in 1994 when Republicans swept statewide offices, or 2018 and 2022 when Democrats swept the statewide races, the other party usually, typically, always at least presents competent challengers in these statewide elections until now. In 2026, Republicans have presented barely passable candidates in the races for Attorney General, Secretary of State, and State Comptroller, and didn't even field a challenger to State Treasurer Mike Frerichs, who will be the first statewide candidate unopposed in this state in at least 90 years, and maybe longer. We can't find records that go back any farther. It's just another signal in a long line of examples of the wilderness that you find the Republicans in here in Illinois.
And Charlie.
One of the provisions that was tucked into the measure ending the shutdown that Congress passed and President Trump signed was a provision that would make it illegal to sell intoxicating hemp products. And that could upend an industry here in Illinois that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And hemp is basically, it comes from the same plant as marijuana. It's just a different variety. And it was legalized under the Farm Bill several years ago. But the law didn't account for other cannabinoids, I guess it's pronounced, and it created a loophole that allowed companies to use compounds made from hemp that have marijuana-like intoxicating effects. They have little or no regulation. And Governor Pritzker has tried for years to try and get some regulation on the industry. So he was glad to see that this happened. The ban doesn't take effect until next November. So there's an opportunity for the state to see if there's a way that they can regulate these hemp-derived substances in the way that we regulate the marijuana industry.
That's all the time we have for State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Patrick Fingston, author of the Illinois Political Newsletter and WMAY radio host. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.